The Judiciary Committee meeting to order. We have Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator McGuire, Senator Wilkowski, and Chairman Coghill here today. Today, the only thing on the schedule is Senate Bill 64, and I'm going to take care of a couple of housekeeping items before we jump into testimony today. Number one, last time I was acting poorly, bad manners. We had Senator Ellis sitting through the whole meeting with us, and as he's walking out the door, I'm thinking, I never introduced Senator Ellis. So my apologies to the senator, but he has been a prime mover in making this bill come to fruition, so I just wanted to make note he's here today. thank you, Senator. Also, here's probably what's going to happen today, be my estimation. We'll probably end up early. I put some amendments out for you to peruse. My expectation, I have not even had a chance to study them out myself, so they're just they just kind of came to my office just like minutes before getting here, so I know it's something I'd like to study. Also, I know, Senator Wilkowski, you brought up a couple issues. It'd be my intention, if you'd be willing to, I put in one of the amendments just to take the issue of the fiscal review. I just couldn't figure out a better way to do it, so I think probably the thing to do is go ahead and take that out, and you'll see that in one of these amendments. I thought that was a good point you brought up. I tried to find a way to make it work. And I don't want it to be something that this bill just gets drugged down on. It's just that's not part of what we're trying to do. So probably take that. I like the idea. I just couldn't figure out how to make it work. I think the Department of Law brought up a couple of good points. The Department of Corrections brought up a good couple of good points. For example, in the duties of probation officers, when on doing the risk issue, having moderate to high risk, they had wanted moderate. I thought that was a good idea. So I'm picking up what I would consider is some of the easier amendments and trying to get them on the table so that when it comes to the policy calls, if we have big debate on the big policy calls, that we can actually have those and move this bill along. So I'd kind of like to get that done by Wednesday if possible. So my expectation is to bring amendments on Wednesday. Let's take from the easiest to the hardest, as best we can, and fix what we think needs to be kind of modified and fixed. Still allow time for public testimony. And then on Friday, we'll have a CS that I think is then whittled down to the bigger policy questions. And I know one of the policy questions is going to be on the conditional driver's license. We'll work, get it as workable as best we can, debate it, and then leave it in, get it out, what do we do? So, and I think it's worth the extra effort to work on that piece, and I don't want us to miss that opportunity. So with that, I know Annie Carpinetti had 2.5 pages of testimony. She was down to the last part of her second page, and I asked her if she would be willing to come forward and finish out her testimony and suggestions. Then we have, I think, Department of Corrections here for questions, and there will then maybe a little committee discussion. I'm not interested in running into all the time allotted. We don't have to be here. I just wanted to set the conversation up so that we have a good working bill. So thank you, Annie, for coming. Put yourself on the record, and we are ready for what testimony you can bring to us.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And I think we stopped around page 17, and I can go through this really quickly.
Thank you. We're not in a hurry, but it's unminded if we do it quickly either.
Right. Again, for subsection O is for drunk driving, and subsection Q is for refusal, applies to refusal cases. I think it would be important to clarify that these licenses are being returned if there's no other type of revocation besides for drunk driving and revocation, for example, a point system or whatever other type of revocation that might have been ordered.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Say that again, please.
Okay. What we are talking about in O and P and Q, excuse me, on page 17 is termination of revocation for people convicted of drunk driving, felony drunk driving, and felony refusal. And it is it's mandatory language that the department shall return a license if these various conditions apply. But I think it also should be clear that we are talking about a revocation for drunk driving or refusal, and not necessarily that it's mandatory for the department to give back a license if a person
has. And just to clarify that, Section 27 is driving while under influence.
Right, drunk driving.
And Section 28 is the refusal.
Refusal, yes.
And those are the two different categories.
Right, but they're the same amendments to each section, and they're really similar provisions of law. One is just applies to people convicted of drunk driving, and one applies to people convicted of refusal to take a breath test. And they're pretty much the same penalty throughout our statutes.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I'm being slow here. So, all of Section 27 is permissive. Both of them are permissive.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, no. Under the current law is permissive. That is, if a person waits 10 years and then applies for a license. But the proposed new language is mandatory. It says the department shall return the driver's license if the conditions are present.
I'm sorry. Okay. All right. So then make your comment again about Section 2.
Okay. My comment is we should probably say in these two sections that the mandatory language applies to termination of license revocations for drunk driving or refusal, and not for a license revocation, for example, for the point system where a person got convicted of five speeding tickets or something.
Got it. Right. Thanks for your patience.
Sure, no problem.
So any of the language somewhere after shall restore needs to say specifically for driving while under the influence or refusal to make that very clear.
I think so. I think it would, because, you know, Title 28 is a really long, complicated title, and I think it doesn't hurt to be as clear as possible.
And what would be, this was brought up in one of our earlier discussions, what would be the draw here? It seems to me like if somebody had their license revoked for point system, mm-hmm. For whatever reason else they can have their, would they go out and get a DUI charge so they can be under this mandate?
Well, through the chair, I wouldn't advise that for anybody, and I hope nobody would do that. But I think it should be clear that a point system, and I haven't read the point system rules in a long time, but they eventually are lifted, I think maybe even automatically, I'm not sure. I don't want to tell you that for sure.
Because, but maybe that's something that we should take a look at, because it touches on the edge of this.
Right. There are a variety of ways a person can lose their driver's license. Some, I think, not having anything to do with driving, like not paying child support or various other things. So we should be clear that what we're talking about.
Just for what it's worth, we do have Tiffany Thomas from the Division of Motor Vehicles and willing to testify today. So I hope, Tiffany, can you hear us? Anyway, I think she's listening in on this. In any case, that's one person we can get to help us figure this out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I spoke with Ms. Thomas this morning on the phone because I was asking her about the provisions under what would be paragraph 1 and how they proceed. She has a lot of good information for you.
Okay, thank you.
Another thing that we talked about Friday, which is, I think there should be some time before you mandate the DMV to give a license back, some time on for driving on a limited license successfully. And that's the same comment that we made under the limited license provision. And finally, I think under our current law, if you are convicted of felony drunk driving or refusal, you have to have an interlock device for 60 months after you get your license back. I think it might not, I think it would be helpful to acknowledge that in this section, saying that you've, you will comply with the interlock requirements under, under the current statutes. On page 18, just a couple really, really mini comments on lines 9 and line 30, just a drafting issue. It probably should say include not consuming controlled substances or alcoholic beverages on both line 9 and line 30. That's a pretty mini comment. But
okay.
And then finally, well, not finally, sorry. Next to finally, on page 20, the risk assessment provisions. We were just, we thought it might be helpful, and I don't know what the intent was, whether or not these risk assessments would be done on people who are, for example, serving their sentence at home or on an ankle monitor. And because it doesn't say, it says just people who have been sentenced to a term of 30 days or more.
So just for what it's worth, this is under the heading that the commissioner can allow them under an established program to conduct the assessment.
Right. This is PACE for subparagraph F, and it's 24-7 for subparagraph G.
Okay,
on line 27. That's a pretty minor comment, but... finally, it would really be helpful to law enforcement and to our prosecutors to have a definite effective date on the bill, because especially for the provisions addressing theft, there is an applicability provision saying that they apply, the new thresholds apply on or after the effective date of the act, but it doesn't, it always helps, I think, people who are running to arraignments and doing charges, like police officers and district attorneys and their assistants, to have July 1st or a date, a specific date, rather than having to, you know, we can send them emails and say this applies, you know, 90 days after it's signed, but it's really nicer for everybody to have a
just
specific.
A real clear start date, basically.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And those are the rest of my comments.
Any questions for Annie? Anyway, I sure appreciate some of the comments. Greatly appreciate it. We do have Tiffany Thomas. Are you online? Can you hear us all right? I have her on off net, I think.
I can hear you, Mr. Chair.
Tiffany, did you hear some of the conversation with regard to the driver's license mandate?
Yes, sir, I did.
I think probably what we need is to hear, number one, your testimony, which I'm grateful for, but some explanation on other ways license can be revoked and why we might need to be a little more specific in this this provision that allows the new ability to drive under certain conditions. So if you wouldn't mind, put yourself on the record, give us your testimony, and help us with some of those questions.
Sure. For the record, my name is Tiffany Thomas, and I'm the driver licensing manager for the Division of Motor Vehicles. My office is the office that oversees the processing of all the DMV limited licenses, as well as the terminations of revocations for both the felonies and the misdemeanors. The DMV's reviewed the new bill draft, and we've been very thankful to have been able to work with the drafter's office to address some of the issues that were raised last April. And the new draft, which is G, addresses the majority of the issues that DMV had expressed with regard to the limited licenses in Section 24. We still got some issues or concerns, rather, with Section 27, and I'm happy to go over those. With regard to Section 27 and 28, which are the sections that Ms. Carpinetti had just commented on, It's not clear from reading the bill if the intent was just to terminate the felony conviction, but the way we're reading that, it doesn't seem as though that's what's happening. It seems as though this bill would wipe the slate clean for people that may have something else on their record if that person was to successfully complete wellness court. The wording, the department shall restore the driver's license, essentially mandates DMV to restore the driving privileges regardless of whether that person has satisfied other suspensions or revocations that might be on their record. And Ms. Carpinetti, she talked about points, but there's other things that might be on their record, such as a child support suspension, an unsatisfied judgment. You can be suspended for failing to comply with mandatory insurance laws, financial responsibility laws, driving wire licenses revoked. There's a whole section under Title 28 for which you can lose your license, both in the criminal side and administratively. So the mandatory language as it's currently written for Section 27 and 28, where it says shall restore, it's also problematic because it's contrary to Alaska Statute 2815031B1, which says that DMV cannot issue a license to a person who is revoked, suspended, or disqualified. So that would need to have some tweaking. Perhaps the language could be changed to may restore, such as what takes place currently, because that gives the DMV the discretion to review the driving record and say, okay, you know, this person is, they've got two unsatisfied judgments for which they need to reinstate from. There's some eligibility concerns for which we wouldn't necessarily be able to restore the license. And then the other concern that we saw when we were reviewing this bill was it creates a different standard for a person with a felony conviction versus a person who may only have the two DUI offenses. And I've heard a lot of back and forth about whether someone would choose to get a felony conviction to be able to qualify for this. I've seen crazier things, so there is that potential that they may choose to do that. You just never know with people. But I guess ultimately, we would like there to be some consistency with the requirements. And then the safety of the motoring public still needs to be considered, because a person, when you're hitting that felony level, you're looking at some substandard driving. They potentially haven't had a license in over 5 years. So the concern would be we're going to be releasing them on the roadway. They haven't had any type of written vision or road test in maybe over 5 years. So that was an issue that we had. You know, what's their fitness to drive? Are they safe to be on the roadway?
So,
and have they reinstated?
So if we put in a provision that specified a required road test or written test?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think you want to make sure, you know, to make sure that they are safe to be on the roadway, because, you know, their vision may have diminished in the time frame between the periods of revocation to the time where they're on the roadway.
Mm-hmm.
I have a driving record that, if the committee is interested in, I would be happy to provide it to you so that I could walk you through what a typical felony driving record looks like, so that you can see that some of the issues that we have are all of these actions compound. So you may have a person who is in wellness court in 2006, but because they have all these other driving actions that they're suspended or revoked for, they may not even begin to serve their felony revocation until 2012. So what happens to those people and all those other revocations that they still have to serve?
That was the other thing I found out the other day, is they don't run concurrently. They run in tandem, right?
In most cases, Mr. Chair, yes, sir, they do. The court can order them to run consecutive. And in most cases, when you're looking at a DUI or a refusal, the criminal action is running it's running concurrent with the administrative action.
Okay.
But everything else, like, for example, if a person got a DUI, and this was their second DUI, so they were out on the roadway and they happened to be driving on a revoked license, there's going to be that subsequent DWLR, and that's going to follow the revocation for the DUI.
Well, I think it would be good for you to get that to the committee, and I will, if you get it to my office, I will make sure the committee members have it, and anybody who's interested, because I know that we hit a complex area here, and I'm trying to figure out ways that if we can let people drive under certain accountability measures, that the public will actually be safer, because it's been my experience that we have many out there creating accidents that are on revoked and uninsured situations.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's consistent with the records that I've seen in my 12 years here at DMV.
I think it would be good to have that, and so I'd appreciate that.
Sure, I'm happy to provide that, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have now, or if you like, after reviewing the driving record, whatever your preference is, sir.
I think once we review that, unless there's any questions at this point, I think we're still looking for enough information to ask the right questions. But it's my intention as a chairman to push this as hard as I can to see if we can find the best answer to get this done. I'm not interested in making the public less safe, I can tell you that. And I don't think anybody on the committee is either. But we also have people that are right now being very risky, and it's a random deal where people are going to get hurt and there's no remedy. And so if we can keep them accountable and have some access to remedy, then that's publicly, I think, more acceptable. So, Tiffany, I sure appreciate your input. If you would make sure that you get in touch with my office with that, and then my guess is as we go into Wednesday, we'll have some more questions on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Also, I have Quinlan Steiner, who public defender, wants to testify, and I think he's also on off-net. Quinlan, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I need to get him turned up a little bit. Either that or you're way across the room, Quinlan.
Can you hear me now?
Much better. So put yourself on the record and go ahead and give us your testimony and whatever we can do to have the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. And I have some comments on the bill. They're mostly technical in nature, but I think there are some potential unintended consequences and some other policy issues that I think are worth discussion. I'd like to start with Section 19, which is the section that addresses what we call Nigran credit.
Okay. Section 19?
Yes, specifically lines 17 through 20, which sort of redefine what kinds of passes you can have in a treatment program. While I think this is an improvement over the prior statute, and I think pushes it away from the McKinley case, which I understand this was designed to respond to and back towards the Nigran case, I think much of the discussion about the language rehabilitative purposes for which somebody can have a pass to leave a treatment program has been a little bit conflicting and maybe contradictory. As it stands now, there's certain kinds of programs have sort of levels of release and different kinds of passes with different kinds of restrictions. And so what the discussion about a rehabilitative purpose can mean a lot of different things. For instance, going to an AA meeting, or it could be for purposes of reintegrating into the community. And I think it would be important for this committee to put on the record what the intent of that is. You know, if it's very, very restrictive in its definition, the term rehabilitative purpose, it may not have that big of an impact on the current scheme of programs. For example, the program at issue in the McKinley case had something called a buddy pass, where somebody who was in a program would be released for a few hours under the supervision of somebody who'd been in the program for longer than them, with more seniority as their sort of supervisor. And according to the programs, I believe those are done for rehabilitative reasons or for reintegration of the community. And the Nigran case was sort of based on this idea that they were limited by the program for time and purpose. One scenario that was brought up was the dinner and the movie scenario as being excluded from this definition. On the other hand, the program might give somebody a pass, a buddy pass, to go visit a family member, and even later on in the program might give that person an individual pass for an afternoon to meet a family member, and that have a rehabilitative purpose, that be part of their reintegration into the community. I think clear legislative history on what that means would be helpful for courts and practitioners to sort that out. You know, if it were too restrictive, you might not actually expand the treatment opportunities to a significant degree, whereas a broader definition, one that was specifically defined by the treatment provider as being for reintegration or some other broader rehabilitative purpose would be worthwhile and would greatly expand it to include things like the program that was at issue in the McKinley case. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Dyson has one, Quinlan.
Yeah, thanks for helping us. Your testimony is always insightful. I may be a little off subject here, but couple of our correction facilities have been doing some pretty good things in terms of letting folks out for jobs that are off-site. And it's not at the farm. The one I'm thinking about has to be a fish processing place. And literally they go out every day and come back and so on. It seems to me that kind of controlled release to off-site activity, i.e. working, ought to count for against their good time. What's your sense of what the law is, what we're saying in the statutes here?
With this change, you could certainly still do that, provided the court didn't somehow interpret the deletion of the work requirement by the treatment program as being somehow excluding it. I don't think it would, but you should be clear about that as well. If the program says this person needs to work as part of our rehabilitative model, then it should qualify for jail time credit, as would, say, a pass to go shopping for clothes so you could interview for a job, or to meet with a mentor to have a discussion about employment, or a family member to discuss some of the issues that are going on with your life. As long as it were up to the treatment program to define what their rehabilitative model was and then it would serve, you know, you would get credit for that potentially from the court. But because there's a certain ambiguity in that term, I think it's important to put that on the record.
I'm wondering if we ought to do more than put it on the record, but perhaps clarify the language. And respectfully, I'm not sure that I want the rehabilitative services, i.e. the treatment people, to have the final up or down on whether or not the work experience is rehabilitating.
You could also put in sort of a safety clause that would say something to the effect of, you know, you exclude periods that were determined later not to be rehabilitative, so that if the program had the option for a pass, but you were in there for a month and didn't take any passes because you were working on other things, then you wouldn't exclude the entire period, even though you were under a confined situation for the whole period, just because you had an option that you didn't take or wasn't available to you because you weren't in the right kind of program. That's another concern about this. The potential for getting a pass might exclude the whole treatment program or the period that's not locked down.
Yeah, I like that. As I understand what you said, the presumption is in favor of the work program unless later information shows that it should have been excluded. Yeah. That seems to be a logical solution. All right. Thank you, sir.
And certainly. And that would also be true for, say, the buddy pass situation. If they determine that it wasn't rehabilitative and you didn't take one, you should still get credit for the periods that you were confined. If you did take one for a day, you could easily write it to exclude that day that the person was not confined, rather than excluding the whole 30 days that they were there, for example.
So, Quinlan, with regard to this language, when the Department of Law was before us, we had the question, why should we exclude work? Because we thought of that as rehabilitative. The problem seemed to arise with the language approved in advance by the court. And I think it came to my attention that that would be cumbersome for both the treatment program and the offender. As to appealing to the court for these kinds of restrictions that just have to name the need, the time, and the place, right? So have you experience with the issue of approved in advance by the court?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The problem with that comes in when for some reason it's not improved in advance, and then you might get work as part of the treatment program and then later not get credit for it. As the original draft that I saw that had it limited or expanded the definition to expressly limited to both time and purpose, you would be fine. You're covered there if the treatment program requires you to work. You wouldn't have to get approval in advance, and then you could, the treatment provider could adjust to whatever rehabilitative purpose they felt was necessary. But once you put in the additional definition of that the path has to be for a rehabilitative purpose, that created a layer of ambiguity that I think needs some clarification. So right now, it's possible you could argue that work wasn't rehabilitative. It wasn't a rehabilitative purpose. That rehabilitative purposes are limited to things like treatment programs and other counseling related to your underlying issues for which you were there, rather than work. Work sort of, in my mind, falls more in the reintegration into the community aspect of treatment, which if you were to say on the record reintegration of the community is a valid rehabilitative purpose, then you would sort of shore up that issue. And the courts would then look to what you say, defining rehabilitative purpose.
So, and that was my thought is, our statutes have a variety of different definitions in them, and either we could make a definition clause for this referenced, or we need to be more clear what we're looking for. So would the definition seem to you to be better, or is there some better way of giving some ability for them to work and rehabilitate under a program?
I think trying to define all the different types of passes that might be rehabilitative might be cumbersome and lead to unintended consequences. It might be enough to say we intend for rehabilitative purpose to include passes to support reintegration into the community, which work is potentially part of. It's part rehabilitative and part reintegration.
All right. Senator Dyson also has a question.
Yeah, just to add a comment to that, one of the criteria by which prisoners are evaluated for their process of release is what they have done with restitution, and particularly court-ordered restitution. As I understand the work release program that Corrections is using now, that some, if not much, of the salary they earn goes to pay for restitution indeed. And not only is that, in my view, a great criteria for evaluating the appropriateness of release, but also is very much a part of the rehabilitation process. So, anyways, appreciate the way you've stated that, sir.
Thank you.
So any other thoughts, Quinlan?
No, not at this time on Section 19.
All right. Then we've got several notes on that, so we'll see if we can hammer out something that we can bring before us Wednesday, because my intention is to try to solve this and maybe some of our DMV issues on Wednesday if we possibly can.
Certainly, and I'd happy to work on offline on that particular
All right.
problem. I'd like to also talk a little bit about Section 16 and 18 that creates a pretrial release condition for a testing program. I have a couple of concerns about pretrial release requirements for testing. One relates to a constitutional concern. This is, in essence, a search and seizure, taking a sample of somebody's breath or some other testing for controlled substances, which in some jurisdictions has been determined to violate the Fourth Amendment. The open-endedness of this condition could create that problem. There really isn't a requirement that there be a specific nexus between the purpose of bail, you know, to ensure public safety and return to court for hearings. It's just so broad that there's no sort of nexus or specificity to the requirement. And some courts have said protecting the public is there at all times, and therefore it's not a special need that gets around the Fourth Amendment. With regard to assuring appearance, it requires, courts have held that it requires some specific findings that the alcohol or drugs leads to the person not coming to court. As a consequence, you might run into a Fourth Amendment problem if someone were later bail violated or charged with a crime. As sort of a more policy-oriented look, I'm also concerned that it may result in more people actually staying in jail. If it becomes overused by the courts and attached to anything that involves or even kind of incidentally involves alcohol, it may make it actually more difficult for people to get out of jail and make bail if it's just habitually ordered without consideration of whether or not it's even possible. You know, it leaves open to the Department of Corrections to determine eligibility requirements, which could leave people out and unable to be released. And also, though I think there's a sliding scale component, if it were not liberal enough, people with insufficient financial resources may be prevented from getting out of jail.
So Quinlan, part of the operative of that is, though, their focus is to be on the least restrictive condition, right?
Correct.
And you think this would not be able to be used under the least restrictive?
Well, it's possible. It's the closest corollary that I can think of that's present now is the third-party custodian requirement.
Mm-hmm.
There's some indication that, you know, it's used in situations where possibly it's not justified under the legislature's original intent, and it's a very difficult hurdle for people to meet is to find somebody who can be around them 24 hours a day. This could have, for lack of a better term, sort of a mission creep problem. It starts to get used more and more because it's been used more and more, and then gets ordered in cases where it doesn't meet that least restrictive requirement.
So one of the questions that comes to my mind when I was looking at this is you've got somebody that comes in and blows 1.0, but their trial date is 40 days away, and they're off on the street, and they're telling them don't drink anymore, but there's no way to make assure the public safety. That seems to me like it would be a reasonable way to use this.
It could be under certain circumstances where somebody wasn't otherwise going to be released, and this satisfied the court. You know, one suggestion would be to limit it to certain types of cases that are so directly related to alcohol and public safety, for instance, felony DUIs or high-level felonies that involve alcohol. That would certainly address any potential concern that it would be overused.
And so that would be, for example, if we took Section 18 and added the section that referenced the DUI specifically, DUI would probably have to be referenced in Section 18 then. Maybe.
You could certainly do that.
All right, that's a thought. I'll put that down as a thought.
One other concern I had is more technical in nature. It's on page 19, line 9. It reads here that requires an offender to, or a warrant to issue if somebody fails to appear for an appointment as required by the program requirements. To me, it reads that somebody has to show up for a particular test where I know in another section it was discussed that these could be done remotely. It's possible that it could be misinterpreted as to requiring appointments and undermining another aspect of the statute. I'm not sure that it would be read that way. I'm just flagging it as a potential concern.
So, and what you're saying is it could be appointment or reporting, right?
Yes, something a little broader to make sure that there isn't a conflict in the statute.
I'll look at that. Okay.
One concern I have with this section is as it relates to probation and parole. The program discusses the requirement of swift and certain, specifically in statute, but not sort of proportional response. One of the things that makes the PACE program work is that the consequences for failing a test or failing to show up are not just immediate and certain, but they're actually short, swift, certain, and short, or proportional. It's possible that with a broad application of this, without some directive for it to be proportional, that the length of time it takes to resolve these cases and then the penalties imposed could grow to be too long to make it effective. What seems to work about these programs is you go in, you're addressed with the judge, and a day or two or three are imposed as a consequence, and then you're back out. That way, you experience the consequence without losing your job, your apartment, or all the other things that are helpful to reintegration into the community. And possibly some legislative direction on that would be helpful.
All right. That went a little over my head, so I'm trying to figure out how I would fit that in here. It would be, what paragraph would I actually work on that in?
I can get back to you on that. I don't have it listed right here which section I was reading from. I was looking at the overall description and purpose of the program.
If you could get me a place where I could land in the verbiage on this, that way I can consider it easily. I'm having a hard time landing on that one.
I think it would be tough to sort of direct the judges what to do, but I think it would be helpful legislative guidance to explain the purpose of the particular program, the PACE type model, which part of the purpose of it is to impose short sanctions so that someone has a chance to experience the consequence and recover enough not to lose their job and everything else.
Okay.
But I can get you something on that. I'd like to discuss now a little bit about terminating the license revocation and limited licenses.
Okay. Back to section 27, right?
23 I'd like to start with.
Okay.
On page 13, line 14, section 23 involves permitting the court to terminate a license revocation for a DUI or refusal. One of the requirements is that the person has not been charged with or convicted of a violation, another DUI or refusal. It doesn't really say that what happens after somebody's charged. For instance, somebody could be charged, it could be determined later that it charged inappropriately and dismissed. They would have been charged, that would prevent them from getting a license revocation. That section could be limited to conviction, or it could be delayed until the charge was resolved, or to make sure that they weren't convicted of something or charged inappropriately and then be barred from getting a license later on.
So,
and it can happen.
Okay. And charged was put in there to allow some of the pretrial issues, the way I understand it, because this is the operative language, right?
Yeah.
So if we left it as or convicted, has not been convicted, we would not be able to use some of the pretrial if I...
Right, if somebody subsequently got charged and then the court or the district attorney's office dismissed it and there was no basis for it in the end, then they would be able to get their license back. But if left uncharged, they would have been charged. They would never get their license back, even though the state dismissed the charge.
I see.
The subsequent charge. You could take out just for not been charged and leave it with convicted of another violation, DUI or refusal, and that would clear up the problem.
Okay, I'll look at that.
On section 24 has the same concern. On page 15, line 3, there it says the court shall immediately revoke a limited license if somebody is charged. It could have been that somebody was charged in another court, and then this would require the court to immediately revoke. If you were concerned about whether or not the charge was legitimate, you could have the revoking court make a specific finding that probable cause existed to support the charge. Or you could leave it for just when the person's been convicted. But with regard to the limited license section, you know, revoking it upon a charge makes a little more sense than in the section where you're restoring a termination.
Seemed to me like
timeframes, but
I'll have to ask Tiffany and Tiffany Thomas. It seemed to me like some of the DMV authority allows on some charges to do an administrative revocation. So I'll have to do some homework on that.
Yeah, this section here on page 15 relates to the court's obligation with regard to a limited license and a subsequent charge. Because they can happen in two different courts, I think it would be important to make sure that the court that revokes the limited license actually makes a specific finding that there's probable cause to support the subsequent DUI or refusal.
Okay. Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah. I hope this is appropriate. I've been concerned for several years about mens rea, the criminal intent, and when someone has a limited license or even has had it revoked, but some in extraordinary circumstances, they go driving. Say a midnight run to the emergency room with someone and there's no one else available, or a situation we've just had where a constituent, the edge of my area, has had a license review 7 years into the process of getting it back, working on a culvert at the bottom of his driveway and had tools and stuff in the pickup, but it actually was within the right-of-way on a not often used road, and got a driving with revoked citation. And what I want is for the people making the decisions to not be forced by our harsh language to forfeit the capacity to make some judgment in those rare situations.
Through the chair, this language would require the court to immediately revoke under the scenarios that you set forth. Certainly there would be a defense in the situation where you were rushing somebody to the hospital under necessity, but with regard to moving your tools, I don't think that defense would be available.
Yeah, that's a concern, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Wilkowski, have a question?
Trying to find a solution to Senator Dyson's concerns, which I think are legitimate. Page 15, line 3, you could probably just add some language to the effect of the court finds that probable cause exists for the person to be charged with, or something to that effect. I think there's probably 5 or 6 words that people who are a lot smarter than I could come up with to fix that problem.
Thank you.
That would certainly work. The court was making an independent determination of probable cause rather than just noting that some other judge reviewed the case as it came in. Judges are required to review charges for probable cause. But I think in the action of revoking a license, it might be worth having them review it and make an independent finding.
And
at the time it's revoked.
All right. I think we can work on that. That does, we want it to be clear because, as stated, Title 28 is pretty dense anyway. Other comments, Mr. Steiner?
On Section 27.
Can I just go back?
Oh, excuse me. Senator Wilkowski also has.
Yeah, thank you. Section 15. I'm sorry, page 15, line 5 again. Test positive under G9 of this section for the use of alcoholic beverages, inhalants, or controlled substances. So I assume that's a zero tolerance. I assume that if someone is tested and they're found to have trace amounts of something in their system, even though they would be not intoxicated, I assume that the reading of this would be the automatic revocation of the license. Is that right, Quinlan?
Through the chair, yeah, that's exactly how I would read that.
Okay.
All right.
And again, now that you raise it, I mean, that same type of problem exists there. There's false positives in any testing scheme and an inability to address whether or not it was a legitimate positive test or to challenge that would immediately result in the revocation of the limited license.
Okay. Please then continue, Quinlan.
On Section 27, page 17, line 16, subsection C of the new section where it says the department shall restore the driver's license if it says the person has not been convicted of a criminal offense since the license was revoked. The corresponding provisions for the court in Section 23 that don't refer to any conviction, they refer to any DUI or refusal conviction. Should you leave it like this, somebody might go through the entire program, later get what might be considered relatively minor criminal conviction unrelated to driving or alcohol that would prevent them from getting their license back. And then the purpose of the program and this provision would ultimately not be served if it's that broad. So it could be limited to DUI and refusal. That same concern rests with Section 28 on line 18, or page 18, line 3.
I'm making a note.
On sections 20 or 32, creating the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, the membership on the commission has suggested, although it involves an appointment of a private attorney, doesn't require any experience that's related to criminal defense. Just be my recommendation as a policy matter that a representative from the defense community be attached to the board. I think the perspective from the defense could provide a lot in terms of the commission's decisions and recommendations.
So specifically referencing defense attorney, right?
If it were to be left to a private, you could certainly say that the private attorney had a substantial career in public defense or criminal defense. you know, I would certainly note that the public defender and the Office of Public Advocacy represent close to, I think, 80% of the criminal defense cases in the state. In the prior version, both OPA and PD were included on the commission. And, I know this is a complete policy call, but I don't think that I or public advocate would have any objection to serving, and I think can bring a perspective to it that would be helpful to the commission.
Point well taken.
My final comment relates to the applicability section, page 25, line 4 through 6. This references the applicability of the Nigrin changes. The way it's drafted now, if it were passed and the applicability was on the date of the offense, you may have two defendants in court on the same day arguing for Nigrin credit, one whose conviction occurred the day before this, the applicability section, and one that occurred the day after. They would be treated differently. They'd be in the court at the same time on the same motion, but their ability to get jail credit would be radically different. My recommendation would be to make it applicable immediately to any court order issued after the applicability date. That way, for practitioners in the court and everyone and all the defendants in court, they'd be treated exactly the same with regard to the litigation of migrant credit or their application of it.
Could you send me a note to that effect so that I have that? I don't want to lose that. Send me a note. And then I know that the Department of Law also talked about, you know, having an effective date that was clear, especially on a couple of these other provisions. I didn't hear them say anything about the Nigrin credit part, but this would be something. The general rule that I understand of law is that from the effective date on, generally, if you are convicted under something prior to the change of the law, that you lived under that. And so how would this affect that again?
That's generally true with regard to sentencing provisions. Typically, it's the effective date of the act would then determine how you were treated at sentencing, not the date of the offense.
Okay.
But here you say specifically Section 19 of the Act applies to offenses occurring on or after the effective date. So you wouldn't get the benefit of that section if you committed your offense one day prior to the effective date, but would if you had it one day after. And so just by the nature of the way cases are handled, those two defendants can be in court at the same time, having completed the same program at the same time. One would get credit and one would not, if they fit within the statutory changes. If you just said it made it apply to all court orders issued after the effective date, then you would eliminate that problem. So it wouldn't matter when somebody committed the offense. What would matter is when they were applying for Nigrin credit.
Okay, that helped.
You could limit it to sentencings if you didn't want it to read so broadly as to be retroactive to prior sentencing. But limiting it to the court order would certainly make it clear that two people in court at the same time could receive credit.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that's the only comments that I have. Thank you.
You gave me quite a few more questions, but I can't answer them in committee. I'm going to have to do some homework. Thank you. I know that we had talked with the department on the 24/7 pretrial issue, so maybe on Wednesday, we can have a little discussion on the pretrial issue. But I'm going to have to do some homework on that myself. Was there anybody in the room that had expected to testify at this point, now that Quinlan's had a chance? I've got Tony Piper with the Department of Health and Social Human Services on, Social Services. I got Suzanne DiPietro with the Judicial Council listening in for questions. I've got Doug Gardner still online with Ledge Legal, who've been helping draft this bill. So if there's any questions from the committee on that, I think we got probably about nine issues, it looks like to me, that I need to kind of shake this thing down a little bit to make sure I understand them. Anything from the committee? Was there anybody else in the audience here that wants to take time to testify? I can tell you it's got my head spinning a little bit right now, so I've got to go back and read some of those questions. Quinlan, I'll probably get back to you. Certainly, Annie, I'm going to get back to you and sit down in my office and try to figure out how I will move this thing forward. So my expectation is, based on this discussion today, I'm still looking for the first and easiest amendments to deal with, and then the tougher ones. Certainly, the driver's license issue is going to be tough. I think we can find a way on some of the rules of evidence or the way that we go forward on court direction. I think we can probably find some good working ground on the NIGRM credit. I think to me the main purpose is to allow for rehabilitation while keeping them focused on the reason they were incarcerated, you know. So I'm not interested in letting people go wander the streets, but as long as we can give direction on that rehabilitation, I'm willing to keep working on that one. Is there anything from the committee at this point? I think we've wandered into a pretty crowded room already.
But not the weeds.
No, we're not in the weeds yet. For Tiffany and for Quinlan, thanks for staying with us. And for those who stayed online, thank you. If you have any comments that you feel we need to be considering, please send them to my office. We will consider them. I'm going to go back, do a little bit of homework tonight, try to get a little more clarity of direction for us on Wednesday. We'll bring amendments. So if any of the committee members have amendments, bring them to me probably as soon as you can, but Wednesday we'll consider them, all right? All right, with that, we'll just call this committee adjourned for the day.